Here in the U.S., the number of banks on the government's problem list has gone up again. In a report card released today, the FDIC says it now has 860 institutions on its official watch list. That's the most since 1993. NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
Robert Klingler is an attorney who represents community banks at the law firm Brian Cave. And just this past Friday, one of the banks he works with failed. He's seen the same thing happen to more than 15 clients already this year.
That day is generally the hardest professional day in that banker's life.
So far this year, nationwide, 149 banks have been taken over by the FDIC. Klingler says most of the failed banks are small community banks that didn't get involved in the kinds of risky subprime mortgages that were the trademark of the financial crisis. Instead, many made loans to real estate developers, building homes and shopping malls. And the recession hit those loans, too.
We've had banks that survived the Great Depression but couldn't make it through the Great Recession. And each one is a traumatic event.
But Klingler and others are quick to point out that just because a bank is on the FDIC's watch list, it doesn't mean it's going to fail. The FDIC's chief economist, Richard Brown, says the number of banks on the list may be growing, but the situation is actually improving.
We've worked through a lot of the problems.
He says the banks in the most trouble have already failed. A lot of those that remain should be able to work through their challenges.
There's a winnowing through the problem banks, and the worst ones are failing now. And we think that next year we'll see failure rates that are lower.
In fact, Paul Mirsky, chief economist for the Independent Community Bankers of America, says banks large and small are doing better. The FDIC's report card says in the third quarter, banks earned $14.5 billion in profits.
Profitability is up, losses are down, asset quality or the quality of loans on the bank's books have been improving slightly as well.
With all this talk of banks in trouble, it's worth noting, since the FDIC was created 75 years ago, depositors haven't lost a penny on insured deposits, despite hundreds of bank failures. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR.
NPR's business news starts with a major insider trading probe. FBI agents raided the offices of three hedge funds on the East Coast yesterday. It's believed these raids are part of a broad investigation into insider trading on Wall Street, as NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Published reports said over the weekend that federal officials are in the middle of an extensive investigation into insider trading. Authorities believe that private consulting firms helped pass on information illegally to their clients, who included some large hedge funds and mutual funds. Yesterday, FBI agents reportedly raided Diamondback Capital Management of Connecticut and Locke Capital Management of Boston. A third hedge fund, Level Global Investors of New York, confirmed that its offices were searched and said it had cooperated fully with the investigation. Earlier this fall, a principal at Broadband Research said he had been approached by the FBI and asked to wear a wire during conversations with his clients, who include some prominent hedge funds. He said he refused to do so. Federal officials are intensifying their efforts to go after insider trading. U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara of New York said recently that insider trading is rampant and on the rise. And he said a lot of it is carried out by some of the wealthiest and most privileged people in modern finance. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Music dating back to the ancient caravans of India can be heard at New York's Lincoln Center this week. It's a spectacle put on by Muslim musicians from the Indian desert along the Pakistan border. Jeff London tells us about a show intended, more than most, to draw you into the music.
The Manganiyar seduction begins in almost complete darkness. Light bulbs faintly illuminate 36 human-sized rectangular boxes on a large four-tier set. Then the sound of a kamacha, an Indian stringed instrument. and slowly lights come up on one of the boxes to reveal the musician sitting cross-legged, dressed in white, with an orange turban.
So it's very introspective, and it's this one lone Camacha drone that actually starts seducing you into yourself.
Royston Abel is the director and creator of the Manganiar Seduction, and he wants to seduce the audience slowly with this Sufi music. After a while, another box lights up, and another musician, also in white, with a multicolored turban, begins to sing.
They're all Sufi couplets, and it's all crying out to the universe or God, you know, so it's like a major asking for some kind of a blessing that we start the piece with.
And before you know it, that singer is joined by another singer and another and another. The Manganiar Seduction is something of a hybrid. Not exactly a concert, not exactly a traditional theater piece, but something designed to illuminate and make the audience feel the music of the Manganiars. A formerly nomadic group, they live in Rajasthan, a desert region in India, and have kind of a hybrid faith themselves, says Royston Abel.
They have the Muslim saints, and they worship Allah, and then they also have their pagan Hindu goddesses. And they sing to both, like there would not be any difference if they were to sing a Sufi Islamistic song or if they were to sing an Hindu mystic song, it would be with the equal amount of devotion.
Jane Moss is Vice President of Programming at Lincoln Center, and it was her idea to create the White Light Festival, drawing from Western and Eastern traditions to explore spirituality in music.
We were not interested in producing, let's say, a generic world music festival or a sacred music festival. We were really interested in works of art that sort of come at these issues in interesting different ways.
Director Royston Abel, who runs the Indian Shakespeare Company, says he was introduced to the music of the Manganiars when he worked with a pair of musicians on a production which traveled to Spain.
They slowly seduced me into their lives, and then they took me onto a journey and just took me to a point where they really blew me away.
So he decided to create a show which reflected his own journey into this music. Abel estimates he's auditioned well over 1,000 musicians to find the 36 who perform in the show. But getting the Manganiars to play the same thing every night hasn't been easy.
They're not used to structures. They're not used to a concept of rehearsals. They're not used to playing something that they've been asked to play. They're free-spirited musicians. You know, they just play what they feel like. But trying to get them into my world and me trying to get into their world, slowly, slowly adjusting to arrive at a performance together.
The performance, which takes about an hour and 20 minutes, features many different musical colors and instruments. One part features Indian drums called the dholak and the dhol. And in another part, a double flute.
It's the algoza, which is so special. It's pretty haunting, and it's very typical of this community.
And by the end of the piece, all 36 musicians are performing while the lights on the boxes are rapidly forming different patterns. It's a kind of ecstatic conclusion to the seductive journey, says director Royston Abel.
By the end of it, you're at the top of this spiral, you know? You really don't know if it's a sound or a light show, actually, because you're into another world.
The Manganiar Seduction plays in New York at Lincoln Center's Rose Theater tonight. It plays at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. next March. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Rare is the college student these days who sets his or her sights on a career in poetry. Well, Lon Samantha Chang, director of the prestigious Iowa Writers' Workshop, has published a novel focused on two such aspiring poets and the very different paths they follow. The book is called All Is Forgotten, Nothing Is Lost. Alan Chews has our review.
Roman and Bernard, two poetry students, live near the poverty line as they begin their writing careers at the small Michigan art school under the tutelage of Miranda, a much-applauded and enigmatic poet in residence. Bernard has his Christian faith and a vision of a long narrative poem to sustain him, while handsome but insecure Roman follows his talent into the bed of their illustrious teacher. This secret love affair leads Miranda to award the young poet his first big prize and leads Roman to teaching jobs and eventually the Pulitzer Prize in poetry. He marries and raises a family with one of his fellow poetry students from that old school. But even as he finds success, real love proves elusive to him. His friendship with Bernard founders, and when in the middle of a long marriage he reveals the secret of the love affair with the poetry teacher to his wife, the marriage splits asunder, and Roman's world loses all luster. This relatively short novel begins small, but blossoms into a full and resonant story of the pains and perils, falsehoods and truths of trying to be an American artist, in this case poet, against all odds, psychological and social. In its own way, it is rather unforgettable. Chang doesn't give us much of Roman and Bernard's actual work, just snippets and praises. The real poetry comes in her prose.
The novel is All Is Forgotten, Nothing Is Lost by Lon Samantha Chang. Our reviewer, Alan Chews, teaches writing at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station. This is NPR.
Let's turn now to a crackdown here in the U.S. on for-profit colleges and universities. New federal rules will pressure them to make sure students graduate, get jobs, and repay their student loans. The industry has tried hard to fight those regulations, but as NPR's Larry Abramson reports, there are also signs the industry is trying to improve its image and students' chances for success.
At ITT Technical Institute in Chantilly, Virginia, students pay around $16,000 a year for training in fields like computer technology, electronics, and criminal justice. Why do people pay so much money for classes you could take a lot less at a community college? Spokeswoman Deborah Brent says students here get a smooth path into the job market thanks to career counseling and good relations with government agencies just up the road.
The FBI came in, the CIA came in. They looked at our students, but it really helped that they were here and you know, were investing in their education, had the right fit.
But many students say when they got out of ITT Tech, they got nothing. Jerry Rohde studied computers at the ITT Tech School in Mount Prospect, Illinois.
Well, they said that they have, like, the state-of-the-art career services that is always there for you 24/7, and they don't do anything.
Rohde says the school just sent him want ads from Craigslist. When he complained, they threw up their hands.
They just tell me that they don't have any leads right now, and they just blame it on the economy.
So Jerry Rohde is working at a mortgage company. It's the only way he can make the payments on the $40,000 loan he took out to pay his tuition bills. Industry critics say the for-profit business model is a big part of the problem. Schools rely on constant growth in enrollment to satisfy investors. So they end up attracting students who aren't ready to study or aren't financially savvy enough to repay huge loans. Margaret Ryder prosecuted these firms repeatedly during her 20 years in the California Attorney General's office.
These are businesses, private businesses, that are relying 80 to 90% on government money. And so they will do what they have to do to keep the government money.
Government money in the form of loans that students take out and often cannot repay. For years, the for-profit industry deflected these criticisms, but a series of embarrassing congressional hearings and an aggressive campaign by the Obama administration may be making a difference.
I think the landscape has changed.
Gerald Price is vice president for Height Analytics, an investment firm. He notes that schools are tightening their admission criteria. Some are now refusing to take students without a high school diploma. Others are spending money on programs meant to weed out unsuccessful students.
It's becoming increasingly important for the companies to focus on retention of their students.
That means doing more than just courting any student who can pay the tab, a tactic that has made for-profit schools infamous. The University of Phoenix, for-profit's biggest player, has introduced a mandatory orientation program for students new to college. University President Bill Pepicello says 80% of students go on to take courses after they take the orientation.
Which means, obviously, that 20% are self-selecting out and do not come into a degree-granting program.
The University of Phoenix has told investors that program and other steps have led to a 10% drop in new enrollments this year. Pepicello describes this as nothing more than a good-faith effort to help students succeed. But for-profit schools have another motive, survival. If they don't shed students likely to default on loans, new regulations being phased in by the federal government will cut off their federal funds. Again, Gerald Price of Height Analytics.
If schools are willing to spend money and invest in particularly year one retention, these are metrics that they can affect.
One thing remains unclear. What will happen to students who can't get into for-profit schools that once took all comers? If they turn to community colleges, they may find waiting lists at schools hit by budget cuts. So the effort to crack down on schools could leave a lot of struggling students in the lurch. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
Later today on All Things Considered, we'll examine why many students are willing to take on huge debts to attend for-profit schools. The simple answer is jobs. And it's Morning Edition from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A 35-year-old computer sold today for more than $213,000. Let me say that again. A 35-year-old computer, $213,000. Yeah. The computer in question is an Apple I. That's the first Apple machine ever made. And it sold to an unidentified buyer at Christie's Auction House in London. Joining us now is Brian Barrett. He's with the tech blog Gizmodo. And Brian, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell us, what did this unidentified buyer get for his $250,000?
Well, just in terms of purely the guts of it, he got a computer that we wouldn't really recognize as a computer today, probably. Physically, it looked like a large wooden box, almost like you would think of a typewriter from that time period would look. So about the same size. It also had sort of a back wooden board that had sort of a hand-carved Apple computer in it. Not the Apple logo that we know today, but sort of very rough, almost elementary schoolish handwriting carved into that back panel. So you get a very, it's just a fun sense of what an early stage project this was, very homegrown. But in terms of historical significance, he got really the first fully preassembled computer ever produced, one of only 200 that were made, and a really important part of the history of one of the most important tech companies in the world today.
You use the word preassembled, and I gather that the innovation of this computer was that the motherboard actually came preassembled. Up to this point, you had actually had to buy the parts and solder them together.
That's right. It was really a sort of an enthusiast activity up until that point, people who were really into the nitty-gritty of making their own motherboards. And it's sort of appropriate that Apple was the first company to usher in this sort of fully preassembled machine, because that's always been one of their hallmarks, is ease of use for the consumer.
Now, the memory on this machine would have been a lowly 8 kilobytes, which, to put in perspective, you couldn't even store one song on there, forget a movie. What could you do with a computer with that small a memory?
Well, you know, not very much, especially, you know, given what we are used to being able to do today. I think you can think of it as sort of a very fancy calculator at the time. But you also had a cassette interface, so that means that you could record things from the device to a cassette and vice versa. So it did have that capability, but in terms of what it did, it's a computer in that it literally just computed things. You could, you know, do some light programming, but it was certainly nothing that we think of in terms of even just word processing or that we do today with our machines.
So the allure for computer buffs out there would be, as you suggest, really just owning a piece of computer history.
I think so. I mean, especially knowing the history of this particular device, Apple was a very small company at the time. This was sold out of the garage of Steve Jobs, I believe Steve Jobs' parents. And if you have $213,000 to spend on something and you're a fan of computer history, this is pretty much as good as it gets in terms of getting a core bit of that legacy.
Well, Brian Barrett, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Oh, thanks again for having me.
That's Brian Barrett. He's a reporter with the tech blog Gizmodo, and he was talking about the sale today in London of a 35-year-old Apple I computer.